live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. Nice to have you with us today. I'm Gary Null, on the road. Today, avocados. They've been deemed a perfect food. Why? What are they going to do for us? Well, I'll talk about that. Also, a lot of people go to see nutritionists, and many of the nutritionists they see are registered dietitians. Now, if you didn't know about what goes into becoming a dietitian and how they can be influenced, you might not be getting the best information you could. I'll talk about that. Dr. Joseph Marcola on Health Impact News has an article entitled, "Why Are Nutritionists Sponsored by Junk Food Companies?" Really? Which ones? And how does that impact what they're going to tell you what to eat? I'll share that with you. Also today, the unexpected benefits of olive leaf extract, excuse me, and there are a lot of them, and I'll get into that as well. Then from our commentary section today, John Whitehead has an article, short, powerful. It's going to be added to the Fascism in America series that I'm doing. It is entitled The Age of Authoritarianism, Government of the Politicians, by the Military, for the Corporations. Then, from Daniel McGuire, from Consortium News, Obama distorts just war principles. You've all heard him explain how there's the good war, like Afghanistan. No, there's not. And Daniel McGuire is a professor of religious ethics at Marquette University. Then Consumerism and Its Discontents by Charles Gerber, Truthout. Also, on issues, I'm going to show one more example of how everyone this president selects is opposed to anything that represents the true values of the American public. Glenn Greenwald on Obama's new FBI choice, and you'll be surprised at who Obama chose to run the FBI, the new person. My guest in the second part of our program, Dr. Omar Manjawala, will talk about the psychological phenomena of craving and the reasons why we cannot seem to get enough of that which we crave for. And he is an expert on cravings. So we'll talk with him. We have a lot to share. Let's begin. Most people don't eat avocados. And that's because we have this idea that they're fattening. They are not. They're extremely beneficial. Here's just the latest on why the avocado has been called the perfect food by many. And think of when was the last time you had avocado. Maybe you had some guacamole, but for most people, it's not there. Here's what it can do. The latest science shows that avocado helps with brain function, encourages weight loss, is an enormous benefit for having a healthy heart and warding off heart disease. And also it has the good fats, the kind of fats that we want, and it increases the good HDL cholesterol. It lowers our intake of sugar and sugar cravings. It's very dense in nutrients. It actually helps us lose body fat. So those are the latest studies. One study, just as an example, shows that eating a hamburger with one half of an avocado led to an inhibition of interleukin-6 production. Now, those of you who have heard my series on inflammation know that inflammatory compounds play a major role in increasing our risk of heart disease, cancer, diabetes, Alzheimer's, macular degeneration. So think of it this way. Think of all the people in your life. I know all of the people in my life. Growing up, not one, not my best buddies, not my family members, aunts, uncles, nobody would ever listen to me. And no matter what they did, they always assumed that there would be no price to pay for it. No matter what I would do, I'd come home on a regular basis because I enjoyed seeing my mom and dad and my family. And I'd always bring a book that I'd published and I'd bring a whole box of vitamins and we didn't have any organic produce in my hometown, so I'd frequently ship that which wouldn't go bad in, like I'd ship a case of organic apples in. I would get there, I never saw a single bottle of vitamins open. But I'd say, what are you doing with the vitamins? Oh, we show everyone. See, Gary sent us these vitamins. I said, the idea is, Mom, not to point back that I got you vitamins, use them. Oh, if we really needed them, you know, our doctor would tell us to use them. Mom, the doctor is sick. He smokes, he drinks, he's overweight, you know, and you're going to take his advice. Well, he is the doctor. That's the frustration I had to do. And we'd all be sitting at a dining table. And of course, they'd always be eating, you know, these big pieces of meat with fat on it and everything bad. And I'd be eating a salad and they'd say, there's Gary. He's our little rabbit son. Gary, how's that rabbit food taste? Of course, I don't think anyone in my family actually ever ate a real salad. Iceberg lettuce is what they used as a salad. Well, all that causes inflammation. And inflammation is what leads in time to organs failing, cancer developing, your pancreas no longer functioning. And interleukin-6 is one of those pro-inflammatories. So today, if I simply said, okay, I can't stop you from eating your hamburger, but why don't you have some avocado with it? So it's just like a health drink. One of the ways I help people, in fact, there's just a person you're going to hear in 2 weeks. They've just been 2 weeks into a protocol, not even Sunday, it's 2 weeks, an Alzheimer's, an advanced Alzheimer's. It was not getting any results up at Columbia. And already the daughter says she's seen a remarkable turnaround in her mother. Just, she said she can't believe it, that it would happen this fast. I said, well, let's wait 2 more weeks and you and your mother both come on the show and you can tell your stories. But turning off inflammation in the brain is the very first thing you got to do. The mother doesn't like to eat healthy. So you got to disguise it. And so I told the daughter who's taking care of her father and mother, father's 84, 85, disguise all the good stuff in a smoothie. What does she like? Chocolate? Does she like vanilla, strawberries? What flavor? Then you select the flavor. Then you put everything in a smoothie that's good and disguise it. Well, you can do the same thing with avocado. There's a lot of ways you can use avocado, including avocado oil, the raw cold-pressed oil. It's terrific. In fact, one thing you can do, let me just give you one way you can disguise avocado for those who wouldn't normally eat it, is you marinate it. You take orange, the whole orange juice, and you mix the orange juice with the avocado and put in about a half a teaspoon of anise seed, and you blend that, and then you stuff that into a tomato and put some salt and pepper, Himalayan sea salt and pepper on top. And then when they eat the stuffed tomato, they're not tasting it, or you can stuff mushrooms, same way. You can get white cap mushrooms, take off the stem, stuff the avocado in there, or you could dice up some, another way you can dice up, or you can make some brown rice. This is very easy. This is no brainer. You make your organic brown rice, separately saute thinly sliced, I mean real thin, like in that prison scene in the Goodfellow movie where the guy in prison is slicing the with a razor blade. You slice at low temperatures, you saute your garlic, lots of it, and then put in there sun-dried tomatoes with the seasonings that come with the sun-dried tomatoes, or sun-dried peppers, either one. Then you take those two things and blend them in a blender with avocado, like a whole avocado. Then when your rice is done, completely finished, and it's steeped, and you take it off, it's nice and fluffy, because if you use coconut oil when cooking it, it protects it and keeps it fluffy. Then blend in the rice and the avocado together. Now what this does, it gives a very interesting flavor, a delicious flavor, and you can put olives in there if you want to, it takes on a very Italian quality taste. So they think they're eating something that they're not. You'd never guess they're eating avocado. They can't see the avocado, and they can't really distinguish the taste of the avocado. And that's why sometimes even a very healthy food, one of the most perfect foods for finicky eaters or unhealthy eaters, you have to disguise things. But for those of us who don't have to disguise anything, just try to get more avocado into your diet. It can help every part of your body. Now, some comments from Dr. Joseph Marcola. By the way, just as this audience probably knows, at least those who've been listening, but not those who are tuning in by the thousands every single day, I'm a registered dietitian. I graduated with my degree and my certificate in dietetic sciences, got board certified at the state level and nationally certified. I'm also a nutritionist, both at the undergraduate, graduate, doctorate level. So this is something that I'm very familiar with. And hence, I think he's made some very important points. Let me quote this from an article entitled, "Why Are Nutritionists Sponsored by Junk Food Companies?" Can you rely on the government to provide objective health-promoting dietary advice about the food guide, now known as My Plate? The short answer is no. The reality of how government bows to food industry interests is shocking and most certainly plays a role in the obesity epidemic. How about registered dietitians? Surely you can trust their advice. After all, their specialty is nutrition food science. Disturbingly, a recent report exposing the deep conflicts of interest between the processed food industry and the trade organizations for food and nutrition professionals in the U.S. shatters any illusion you may have had about registered dietitians are the go-to source for well-researched, science-based nutrition advice that will improve your health. The report aptly titled, "And Now Word from Our Sponsors, Are America's Nutrition Professionals in the Pocket of Big Food?" is written by Michelle Simon, who has practiced public health law as long as I've been doing this site, about 17 years. Many of you may not be aware that public health law even exists as a specialty, but it does. Michelle's been a real advocate for public health. And she says, quote, "I realized that there weren't many people at that time making the connection between what we eat and our government policies. I look at the politics of food and then apply my legal background to expose the various ways the industry influences our government policies and so forth." Her most recent expose involves the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics, formerly known as the American Dietetic Association, and the corporate politics involved in making public dietary recommendations. It all began with people sending her photos of all the big junk food companies exhibiting their wares at the Academy's annual meetings, showing her there was a problem going on. 2 years ago, Michelle decided to investigate the situation, which turned out to be eye-opening. Quote, "You walk into this expo show floor and you think you're in the wrong place. You think you can't possibly be in a nutrition conference. It actually looks like one big junk food expo. After that first year of writing about it, I took a much deeper dive over the last 6 months or so to really uncover exactly how these relationships work between the major junk food companies and this very influential trade group. As Michelle discovered, food companies like Coca-Cola, General Mills, Nestle's, Kraft, and all the other major junk food purveyors buy sponsorships to be at the American or the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics annual trade organization meetings. They typically end up having the largest booths on the expo floor. Besides showcasing their food products, they're also allowed to sponsor hold educational sessions at the meeting. According to Michelle, Nestle paid $50,000 for the benefit of doing a special session in which they talked about optimum hydration. For example, quote, "It's probably no coincidence that Nestle is also the largest bottled water company in the world. So it's basically a pay-to-play operation where these companies pay big money. In exchange, they also get to teach registered dietitians for continuing education units. So the registered dietitians who are there to make sure they get their continuing education units can do that by learning about optimal hydration from the nation's biggest bottled water company," And that's just one example. Now, Coca-Cola also sponsors ongoing educational webinars year-round. So to get continuing education units, registered dietitians can be educated by Coca-Cola on the virtues of aspartame, for example, and that sugar in children's diet is okay in moderation. According to Michelle, these ongoing and integral relationships between major food companies and the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics, which is the nation's largest trade group for nutrition professionals, represents huge conflicts of interest. The Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics represents 74,000 of the nation's health professionals, whose job it is to help Americans eat right. At each annual meeting, as many as 13,000 registered dietitians are in attendance. Some have been in the profession for a while. Some are students, young and impressionable. This is a huge meeting that happens every single year where these companies get to show off their latest, slightly better view junk food. Most physicians, as most people reading any article about health, don't receive much training in nutrition, if any. So typically a physician is really busy in his practice and doesn't feel it's worth the time, effort, and energy to counsel his patients on nutrition. They'll be referred to an RD and then assume that their patient will receive the correct and proper advice, seeing how the registered dietitian is trained, licensed, and attended continuing education. It's a nice loop, Michelle says, where corporate interests massively undermine and manipulate any real knowledge of what it takes to get healthy in terms of the foods you eat. Clearly, the dietary advice Americans get is fatally flawed. A staggering 2/3 of Americans are overweight, and 1/4 to 1/3 of all adults are obese. This in turn drives skyrocketing diabetes, and according to the American Diabetes Association, 22 million people are living with type 1 or type 2 diabetes, and the food industry is quick to point out that the choice is always yours. They're not making you buy something you don't want, they say. They also want to blame the obesity problem on people's unwillingness to exercise. However, when the largest junk food manufacturers on the planet are the ones teaching dietitians about nutrition and what makes for a healthy diet, clearly the food industry carries a much larger burden for responsibility than these companies are willing to openly admit. And so, who are the companies educating dietitians? Nestle's, Coca-Cola, Kraft, Pepsi-Cola, the nation's largest food company, which besides soda also owns Frito-Lay, the largest snack food company, and Gatorade, ConAgra, one of the biggest processed food companies, General Mills, purveyors of candy cereals aimed at children, and now the National Cattlemen's Beef Association is a sponsor, the National Dairy Council is a sponsor, even fast food companies like McDonald's are represented at the annual meeting. So the article goes on, but you see where this goes. And here is my thought, because this is something, being in the field, being a registered dietitian, counseling probably more individuals one-on-one than any dietitian in history, I can tell you that they're not getting people well. In fact, in 1 year, 50,000 Americans died of malnutrition that they got in hospitals by eating hospital food. Now, wouldn't you think that if one group of people, dietitians who are responsible directly for implementing a doctor's suggestion, it's just a suggestion on a diet, but when you kill 50,000 patients in a hospital, maybe that might get someone's attention. These are the least qualified people in the world to be advising on what people should be eating. And yet schools routinely have a registered dietitian to decide the food they get. And you've all seen the type of food most schools serve. That's unfortunate. So I wouldn't ever suggest you go to a registered dietitian until you first ask, are you a regular registered dietitian or are you a holistic dietitian? If they have to ask, what's a holistic dietitian, I'd select a different one. There are registered dietitians who have gotten the traditional education and the licensure so they can practice, but then their real education is obtained by looking at all the quality information that is out there that has nothing to do with supporting junk foods. And finally, the benefits that you wouldn't expect from the olive leaf extract. I read an interesting article last night by Julian Everson, Life Extension. And he was showing all the studies that show that this unique molecule that provides olive oil with its multiple health and life-extending benefits, and this particular polyphenol can help lower bad cholesterol and blood pressure. It can prevent cancer. It can protect against oxidative damage. It can help guard against cognitive decline. It also provides the distinctive tangy, pungent, almost bitter flavor found in high-quality extra virgin olive oils. It's also responsible for most of olive oil's antioxidant, anti-inflammatory, and disease-fighting characteristics. In fact, this polyphenol was given to animals with tumors, and the tumors completely regressed and disappeared in 9 to 12 days. The olive tree, of which I have, I think, 7 growing, haven't produced yet, takes a while. They produce abundantly in the leaves as well as in the olive fruit itself. And the special processing techniques now allow for the extraction of a stabilized, standardized form of the polyphenol. That means that consumers can have access to one of the most beneficial components of olive oil without the necessity of consuming the olive oil. You can have the olive leaf extract. And it contains the same ones. It can also lower blood pressure, can do all these wonderful things. It can help with arterial health, which is crucial that we have more people have healthier endothelial cells that line the arterial walls, and that helps maintain blood flow and blood pressure. It also regulates the distribution of smooth muscle cells and sustains an even flow of blood through the vessels. And endothelial dysfunction is one of the earliest stages in hardening of the arteries. And so you're getting healthier heart, healthier epithelial, a less blocking. It can help with diabetes as well. And it also is antibacterial and antiviral. It can help with cancer. And it turns off inflammation. And that inflammation is a major promoter of tumor growth. So, and finally, olive leaf extract and its polyphenols help protect your brain and central nervous system from the destruction brought on by strokes or age-related degenerative conditions like Alzheimer's and Parkinson's. So make sure that you're getting your olive leaf extract each day. I would suggest upwards of 1,000 milligrams. One last thing, magnesium, the newest studies from Harvard meta-analysis, where they looked at multiple studies involving over 313,000 people published in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition, showed that the higher intake of magnesium has a 22% reduction in the risk of ischemic heart disease. So that is terrific. I would suggest 1,000 milligrams a day of magnesium, preferably from citric acid, from citrate. Back in a moment. Please stay with us.
I remember my first love affair. Somehow or another, the whole darn thing went wrong. But my mama had some great advice, so I thought I'd put it in the words of this song. I can still hear her saying, boy, oh, I see you sitting out there all alone, crying your eyes out, 'cause the woman that you love is gone. Oh, there's gonna be a whole lot of trouble in your life. Oh, so listen to me, get up off your knees, 'cause only the strong survive. That's what she said, only the strong survive. Only the strong survive. Yeah, you gotta be strong. You better hold on. Don't go.
Nice to have you with us, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. Out on the road, finishing up a major film in the next 2 weeks. Now for a brief commentary on the subject of fascism. From John Whitehead, the article is entitled The Age of Authoritarianism government of the politicians, by the military, for the corporations. President Obama's declaration that America is at a crossroads in the fight against terror, a fight that is increasingly turning inwards, setting its sights on homegrown extremists, should give every American pause. We have indeed reached a crossroads. History may show that from this point forward, we will have left behind any semblance of constitutional government and entered into the militaristic state where all citizens are suspects and security triumphs freedom. Certainly, this is a time when government officials operate off their own inscrutable, self-serving playbook with little in the way of checks and balances. And while America and citizens are subjected to all manner of indignities and violations with little hope of defending themselves, we have moved beyond the era of representative government and have entered a new age. Let's just call it the age of authoritarianism. Even with its constantly shifting terrain, this topsy-turvy travesty of law and government has become America's new normal. Don't believe me? Well, let's take a little guided tour. First, with the executive branch. Whether it's the Obama administration's crackdown on whistleblowers, the systematic surveillance of journalists and regular citizens, the continued operation of Guantanamo Bay, or the occupation of Afghanistan, Barack Obama has surpassed his predecessors in terms of his abuse of the Constitution and the rule of law. Despite his prior stint as a professor of constitutional law, President Obama, like many of his predecessors, has routinely disregarded the Constitution when it has suited his purposes, operating largely above the law and beyond the veil of secrecy and specious legal justifications. Then we have drone strikes on American citizens. For almost 2 years, the United States government has been targeting American citizens abroad for death by drone. Now, these assassinations of individuals entitled to the full protection of the Constitution have been carried out without any due process whatsoever. No charges detailing their alleged wrongdoings were brought before them. No trial was conducted to determine their guilt or innocence, and no convictions of guilt were found. Obama has also gone to great lengths to give the impression that the drone assassination program is carefully controlled, highly selective in its process, within the bounds of the rule of law. Yet when hundreds or thousands of innocent women and children among them are being killed as a result of these drone strikes, clearly the process is far from controlled or selective. These so-called signature strikes, which involve targeting groups of unknown men who resemble Al-Qaeda members, are the equivalent of bombing a fraternity house because there are young men inside who may be up to no good. It is a practice that is inhumane, immoral, illegal, and no amount of legal hair parsing or political whitewashing will remove this particular stain. Then we have the expanding the war on terror. Although Obama insists he has no intention of continuing the wars in which the United States is embroiled, administration officials are sending an altogether different message, namely, that America's engagement in the ongoing war on terror spans the entire globe. At a recent congressional hearing, Michael Sheehan, the Assistant Secretary of Defense for Special Operations, cited the authorization to use military force law as justification for the administration's ability to send American troops to places like Yemen and the Congo without first seeking congressional authorization. Sheehan also asserted that the United States' conflict with Al-Qaeda will last for at least 20 years. As Senator Angus King, independent of Maine, remarked to Sheehan, "You guys have essentially rewritten the Constitution here today. I don't disagree that we need to fight terrorism, but we need to do it in the constitutionally sound way." Then law enforcement. By and large, the term law enforcement encompasses all agents within a militarized police state, including the military, the police, and various agencies like the Secret Service, FBI, CIA, National Security Agency, etc., having been given the green light to probe, poke, pinch, laser, taser, search, seize, strip, and generally manhandle anyone they see fit in almost any circumstance, all with the general blessing of the courts. America's law enforcement officials, no longer mere servants of the people entrusted with keeping the peace, are part of an elite ruling class dependent on keeping the masses corralled, under control, and treated like suspects and enemies rather than citizens. The legislative branch. It is not overstating matters to say that Congress may well be the most self-serving, semi-corrupt, I would disagree with him, I would say fully corrupt, institution in America. Abuses of office run the gamut from elected representation, neglecting their constituents, to engaging in self-serving practices, including the misuse of eminent domain, earmarking hundreds of millions of dollars in federal contracts in return for personal gain and campaign contributions, having inappropriate ties to lobbyist groups, and incorrectly or incompletely disclosing financial information. Pork barrel spending, hastily passed legislation, partisan bickering, a skewed work ethic, graft, and moral turpitude have all contributed to the public's increasing dissatisfaction with congressional leadership. Thus, it is little wonder that a recent Gallup poll shows Congress with a 79% disapproval rating. The judicial branch. The Supreme Court was intended to be an institution established to intervene and protect the people against the government and its agents when they overstep their bounds. Yet through their deference to police power, preference for security over freedom, and evisceration of our most basic rights for the sake of order and expediency, the justices of the United States Supreme Court have become the architect of America's police state in which we now live. As a result, sound judgment and justice have largely taken a back seat to legalism, statism, elitism, while preserving the rights of the people has been deprioritized and made to play second fiddle to both government and corporate interests. And lastly, a suspect society. Due in large part to rapid advances in technology and heightened surveillance culture, the burden of proof has been shifted so that the right to be considered innocent until proven guilty has been usurped by a new norm in which all citizens, all, are suspects. This is exemplified by police practices of stopping and frisking people who are merely walking down the street and where there is no evidence of wrongdoing. Making matters worse are terrorism liaison officers, such as firefighters, police officers, and even corporate employees, who have been trained to spy on their fellow citizens and report any suspicious activity, which includes taking pictures with no apparent aesthetic value, making measurements and drawings, taking notes, conversing with someone, or any kind of radical view. And then these are given to fusion centers, which are the driving force behind the government's quest to collect, analyze, and disseminate information on every American. I haven't even touched on the corporate state, the military-industrial complex, SWAT team raids, invasive surveillance technology, zero-tolerance policies in the schools, over-criminalization or privatized prisons, to name just a few. But what I have touched on should be enough to show that the landscape of our freedoms has already changed dramatically from what it once was and will no doubt continue to deteriorate unless Americans can find a way to wrest back control of their government, reclaim their freedoms, end quote. You'll have a chance now to call in before I go to my guest in about 5-6 minutes for talkback. I'd like your point of view. 888-874-4888, 888-874-4888, and you can give us your thoughts. Let me give you just some of the upcoming programs. I have a real good program on Progressive Commentary Hour on Monday evening, 7 o'clock, where we're going to take on the pro-vaccination efforts to mandate vaccines and to hold parents of unvaccinated children legally liable for lawsuits. You can bet the pharmaceutical industry is all over backing this. I'll have on Dr. Tony Bark, a pediatric board-certified physician, and Professor Mary Holland, who is a director of the Graduate Legal Skills at New York University Law School. And then on the next day, I'll be talking about what does a systematic collapse look like. I'm going to spend a long time on this because I'm going to have a Dmitry Orlov on talking about what happens when you have a convergence of 5 separate collapses: financial, commercial, political, social, and cultural. Well, he saw it in the Soviet Union. We're going to be seeing it now. Then I'm going to have my next day, I'm going to have the CDC perjured itself and gave misinformation in his testimony on vaccination and autism to a recent congressional subcommittee. Dr. Brian Hooker, professor of biology at Northern California, will be here to talk about that. And I have The Future of Rationing and the Basic Essentials of Life, Dr. Stanley Cox, senior scientist, researcher at the Land Institute in Salina, Kansas, with a doctorate in plant genetics. He worked for the U.S. Department of Agriculture 13 years. Those are some of the topics next week. These are progressive topics. I select the topics and information based upon everything that I feel is not essential in the mainstream and alternative media, things that can actually empower us. Now, we're going to go to our listeners and not going to take any health questions now, just your comments on the commentary I just gave. So if you have some thoughts, please share them. We have Luann Panessi on the line. Hi, Luann.
Hello, Gary. You know, I get a lot of emails from people, and right now I'm getting emails about people who are contemplating coming to your retreat in the site that you chose in Texas. And I just wanted to share a very, very interesting observation. We have a lot of people, especially from the West Coast, who are emailing me and saying, gee, you know, I know it's something that I should do. It's something that I want to do. And when they reflect on what's going on in their lives, they feel like generating revenue, making money has become kind of who they are, what defines them. And they feel very nervous and unsettled about leaving for a week or two to come to a retreat. So on one level, they know they should go, but on another level, they feel that they really have to stay there and make money. And the irony of it all is that, you know, these are people, I have one here that's saying that she's suffering from irritable bowel syndrome. I have a guy with Crohn's disease. I have a woman with GERD or reflux. And they're coming out with all these chronic illnesses, and they feel like they know they should do something about it, and yet they're living in fear as if they have to work instead of taking time out and taking care of themselves. It's an observation that I'm seeing, and I wanted to get your take on this.
It is not uncommon to find that many people, when faced with a priority, should they put their energy and effort into themselves and their own development, or should they adhere to that which is somewhat certain, their financial security, or the environment that they're so comfortable and used to, even if that environment is destructive. All this comes from fear. It was John Berryman who said, we must travel in the direction of our fear. And I find that that is the first step of helping people liberate themselves. What we deny, we cannot change. If we deny our biases, our prejudices, our limitations, our arrogance, our ego, if we deny, I know someone that I can't tell you how many times this person has been in workshops and lectures and always asks the same questions. It's always about love, and yet everything this person manifests in writings is based on hate. So this person's living in denial. So if you live in denial of something, how can you change it? You can't. Where the authentic self wants to change, wants to grow, wants to experience life, the conditioned self, which is frequently manifesting conditions from early in life, pre-intellectual development, so it's pure epigenetic emoting, that person has become everything in their environment. If they had an overbearing mother or father or a person that did not treat them with the love or respect they deserve, then there's a part of them that doesn't believe that they deserve that love and respect, and as a result, will constantly try to prove themselves through overdevotion or overwork or overcommitment. And you frequently see this people who are trying to be healthy, they become manic in trying to be healthy. And yet they are the least healthy people I know, because health is not just physical, it's also spiritual and emotional.
So
and
true.
Also people confuse what they do with who they are. And all the time in our society, we judge each other based upon what we've achieved, filling the void of our lives with something that is supposed to be of substance. If you're the average person, there's nothing of substance there. We're told. As a result, they have no value. We're told. And only those people have achieved a great deal. Look at your lot. Look at their money. Look at what they, look at their clothes. They've achieved something. Therefore, they filled this void in their life. But nobody ever questions the life itself, as if, you mean I'm only as good as my possessions? I'm only as successful as my achievements? No, I'm a human being. Judge me for my heart, my soul. Judge me for my kindness. Judge me for my care, my empathy. Judge me for my creativity. Judge me for my joy. Do not judge me by what I own or what I've achieved. Those are merely secondary to who I am. And yet people stay limited in confusing the surroundings they have been put into or stay into as if there's a third rail. If they take one step out of their security zone, they will electrocute themselves. So just like cattle, where you put up an electric fence and they sting themselves once or twice, doesn't hurt them. I've stung myself many times on a fence. And then you put down the fence, they stay within the boundary. It is a conditioned response. Well, how many times do we consider the environment we're in, the job we have, the relationship we have being so essential to covering our fear that it validates the substance of who we are instead of being a disguise, a distraction? Was it not Marie Curie who said nothing in life is to be feared, it is only to be understood? Unfortunately, yeah. Egos and power demand special recognition. And that's why every time someone becomes famous or powerful, almost always they act out. And they act out in very immature and embarrassingly inhumane ways. They have to prove that they are different. Why? Why do you have to prove you're different? What's wrong with being like other people? Well, because we don't show respect for what is normal. We only show respect for what is exceptional. And therefore, you have to do something exceptional to get attention. And hence, athletes take drugs to show that they are exceptional. No, they're cheats. And celebrities do exceptional things to be accepted and given roles. But that's foolish. Of course, all this is foolish. Because if we stopped exaggerating, we wouldn't need to be billionaires. We wouldn't need a 1% mindset. We wouldn't need anything at excessive levels. We would appreciate what we have and actually show respect for what we have. We end up aligning with mistaken identities. And so one day we wake up and we look in the mirror and we're terrified because there's no we there. There are fragments, hundreds of fragments. We are a corporate identity. We are a union identity. We are a guild, a sorority, a fraternity. We're an ethnic identity, a racial identity, an age identity, a sexual orientation identity. We are, and then you start looking, we're hundreds of pieces, and then we try to glue these together, and that is the story which we live by. But unfortunately, these stories are disempowering, not empowering. The only thing that empowers you is to validate your authentic life. And if you ever validate your life, then you realize that most of your beliefs and rituals and roles are not allowing you to live a remarkable life. And hence you end up with irritable bowel syndrome, which more often than not, most of the itises are based upon high stress. And the person simply locked the stress into that particular part of the body. Someone else can lock it into another part of the body. So if we want to be free, to grow, and to experience, then we have to take risks. No risk, no reward. Little risk, little reward. And that's how life is. Life is transient. Life can be sustainable in a good way, even as we make transitions. But people want life to be permanent, and they're afraid to letting go what they have. And then they don't value what they could be and should be because they place too much value on what they have. Hope that answers the issue, Luann.
Sure does.
Thank you. Back in a moment with my guest. Please stay tuned. Of an illusion. Let's go out to Los Angeles and say hello to Dr. Omar Manjawala. Nice to have you with us today.
Yeah, thank you. Good to be here.
And you're an expert in addiction and addiction psychiatry, and and the concept of craving. You're also the author of the book, Craving, Why We Can't Seem to Get Enough. Very often, simply stating problems people have with their behavior or physical health is insufficient, and it's necessary to explain the source of problems with some scientific evidence so that they can understand their problems more thoroughly. And there are many forms of addiction that lead to a perpetual craving, like such as the food consumption, as well as its contrary of being constantly on diets, alcohol, different drugs, legal and illegal today, Botox injections. And I'd also like to include power and wealth in the mix. And sure. As you've noted, all of these cravings and addictions have similar neurobiological sources. So please begin by first distinguishing craving from a full-blown addiction, and then summarize the neurobiological mechanisms that contribute to the physical attributes of craving, and then explain the same in terms of behavioral conditioning.
Sure. Wow. Those are good questions. No, you're exactly right. First of all, let me say that, you know, obviously cravings are at the core of addictions. You know, 20 million Americans have some form of substance use disorder. That's not even counting nicotine, tobacco, and the food addictions. Then you've got 500,000 people a year dying from tobacco addiction. You've got the epidemic of obesity, which you have talked about in your program quite a bit, you know, doubled rates in the last 30 years, tripled for children. So you've got and cravings are at the heart of all of those behaviors. And, you know, so I think that when use becomes compulsive, when people can't control their use anymore in a reliable way, that's what we call addiction. There are lots of technical definitions of addiction, and there are various definitions of cravings, but at their core, cravings are strong desires that if you can't fulfill them, they produce this powerful physical and mental suffering and all of the medical and other conditions that go along with them. So when you look at the parts of the brain that are involved in cravings, you're talking about memory, conditioning, habits, the ability to inhibit your impulses, decision making, your capacity to delay gratification. That's very important when it comes to managing cravings, your reaction to internal perceptions and mood, and especially I heard you talking earlier about stress, and stress is directly linked to cravings, and even in rat models, you can show a relationship between stress and cravings, so managing that is absolutely critical. So, you know, it's difficult to summarize quickly the brain science of cravings because there are so many different psychological functions that are involved in cravings. But one area of focus has been an area deep in the brain called the median forebrain bundle, and that's the heart of the brain's reward circuit. So that's a part of the brain that gets activated when rewards exceed your expectations. And there's the ventral tegmental area. Many of your listeners have heard about the role of dopamine and its relationship with reward and craving, and the nucleus accumbens, which has been somewhat misleadingly named the pleasure center, but that's also involved in cravings. There's the amygdala, which involves emotional salience and emotional significance of the experiences that you have. And then perhaps the area that's least understood, the prefrontal cortex, which is responsible for suppressing habitual behaviors. And that, in a sense, you know, being able to suppress our habits is fundamental to being able to manage cravings because so many cravings are linked to our habits. So that's in the brain sense. And then you asked about the psychology of it. It's funny, you mentioned earlier in response to your caller, you mentioned the role of shame, essentially, fear and shame. And I think shame is at the heart of cravings. And the research does support that. There's groundbreaking research, for example, from Thomas Sheff from the University of California, Santa Barbara, that shows that Western societies tend to suppress shame, but also in that same research that the threshold for shame is lower. And what that really means is that we're both more likely to experience shame and more likely to suppress it, which is the recipe for disaster. And, you know, as the gap between what we experience and what we can express grows, we're going to get sicker and we're going to experience cravings more often. And if you just look, for example, at the issue of obesity, education on how to eat has increased. You know, the number of diet books has gone through the roof, the sales of guidebooks have gone through the roof, and the obesity epidemic has essentially scaled directly with it. And there are lots of reasons for that. But even if you think about the people who know how to eat in a healthy fashion, many of them don't. So, you know, I think there generally we know that we need to increase our activity and stop eating junk. There's some disagreement about what that should look like, maybe a lot of disagreement, and nuanced arguments about that. But at its core, you know, even the people who know how to eat well frequently don't. What keeps them from making sustained healthy choices? Where are the bad habits coming from? And ultimately, I think the source is craving.
I appreciate that answer. Thank you.
Yeah.
People who wish to tackle their cravings and addictions exert a lot of willpower to overcome their weaknesses, and often they achieve a degree of success and are left feeling that they have reached some mastery. However, there's what you call relapse thinking, so explain what that is and also address the question about whether or not craving is ever fully cured.
So in the book, I talk about the naive perception of immunity. And to understand this concept, your listeners could think about, well, what's the worst thing that could happen to a gambling addict in Vegas? And the worst thing, of course, that could happen to that person is to win. And any gambling addict who is in recovery will tell you that, because it's that sense that you can control it, that you are successful, that you've mastered it in some way through sheer force of will, that fuels the cycle in an ongoing way. And that's why, if you look at, for example, the recovering alcoholic who's been maybe sober for 89 days, getting ready to pick up that 90-day chip tomorrow, may be even sicker than the alcoholic who is still drinking because of what's going on in their mind, what their plans are and how immune they think they are, or, for example, they may be misattributing their success to the wrong factors. And so I think, absolutely, there's relapse thinking. There's the thinking that you are now immune, that you are fine, that you no longer need to make changes in your behavior, that you can stand still, or that perhaps you did this entirely on your own and you no longer need to seek out your authentic self. You no longer need to connect with others. You no longer need to create a sense of belonging or do the actions that were able to suppress your cravings. In the book, I argue that cravings are much more alike than they are different, that they are mostly about what you start doing and very little about what you stop doing, and that they are mostly best addressed when you are not craving. So cravings are not the 911 call. Managing cravings is not the 911 call you make, oh, my God, I'm craving a Krispy Kreme, I need to go right now. Yes, you do need to do something about that. But really, the time to make changes in your life is when you're not craving, to try and prevent those cravings from happening. So,
all right. I have one final question for you, and it's not about food consumption or drugs or other substances, alcohol. It's about craving power, influence, wealth, because I witness these addictive behaviors in corporate America, in Washington politics, in celebrity culture, and among people who hold very high authority in their particular industry and career. And there's even been a series of mental health experts who now openly label these people as sociopaths.
Right.
Could you talk about that addiction and also the people who are addicted to needing reinforcement in a relationship or what they call needing love?
Right, sort of the codependency type stuff. Well, you know, in a sense, Gary, you answered it yourself in response to the caller, and I completely agree with your response, which is that at its core, it's ego and shame. And so the sense of needing to be propped up, the sense of needing to be better than others, the sense of creating this distance or this inequality from us and others, that's the opposite of spirituality. That's the opposite of connectedness. And so in the end, addiction lives in that space, in that distance between me and you, in the secrecy, in the inequality, in the false observation somehow that we are not connected, that we're separate. Because the reality is we are connected. I mean, it was Maya Angelou who said, you know, we allow our ignorance to prevail upon us and make us think that we can survive alone, alone in patches, alone in groups, alone in races, even alone in gender. So in the end, it's distance from others, it's inequality, it's ego, and at its core, it's shame, which drives that narcissism and drives those addictions.
I appreciate very much what you're saying, and I'm sure the audience does as well. This is all highlighted and in-depth in a very important book, and that's why we invited you on. The book is worth reading, definitely, for this audience, and it's called Craving. Your website is what?
Cravingbook.com.
Cravingbook. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Yeah, I appreciate your show. Thank you.
Dr. Omar Manjawala, Manjawala. We're up to the end of our program. I want to thank you all for listening. I look forward to sharing more on our next program. Now we're going to take a few moments to take calls from people in the audience. Our talkback segment right now, 888-874-4888, 888-874-4888. And this is why men should not write advice columns. Dear John, I hope you can help me. The other day I set off for work, leaving my husband in the house watching TV. My car stalled, and then it broke down about a mile down the road. I had to walk back to get my husband's help. When I got home, I couldn't believe my eyes. He was in our bedroom with the neighbor's daughter. I'm 32, my husband 34, and the neighbor's daughter's 19. We'd been married 10 years. When I confronted him, he broke down and admitted they'd been having an affair for the past 6 months. I won't go into counseling, he says, and I'm afraid I'm a wreck and I need advice urgently. Can you please help me? Sincerely, Sheila. And this is from Gilbert. Dear Sheila, a car stalling after being driven a short distance can be caused by a variety of faults with the engine, starting by checking that there's no debris in the fuel line. If it's a clean check, the vacuum pipes and hose and intake manifold, and also check all grounding wires. If none of the approaches solve the problem, it could be that the fuel pump itself is faulty, causing low delivery press to the injectors. I hope this helps, John. Let's see who we have on. I don't see any calls at this moment. Then let's say hello to Utrice, who's standing by to do her program.
I think that is so funny. That's hysterical. I'm cracking up. Oh, that's too funny. Well, today, if I could hold it together, we're going to be talking about America's new oligarchs, the new ruling class, who, according to our guest, are the high-tech gurus who no one has publicly brought to justice.
Good. That should be very interesting. Well, we look forward to it. Coming in a moment, Utrice Lee. Have a good day.
Thank you.